Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. Nigeria governors from the ruling party say calls for an interim government following the recent presidential election are illegal and treasonous.
The call for an international government, even though it is aimed at preventing the president-elect Bola Ahmed Tinubu from being sworn into office, it has far-reaching ramifications.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris ends her week-long Africa trip in Zambia.
We will continue to advocate for speedy finalization of Zambia's debt treatment and the restructuring.
And Malawi's government tells refugees and asylum seekers to relocate to the country's lone refugee camp by April 15. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria governors from the ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC, say calls for an interim government following the recent presidential election are illegal and treasonous. The group members, who call themselves the Progressive Governors Forum, is calling on Nigerians to resist what they say is an attempt to undermine the country's democracy. The chairman of the group, Atiku Bagudu, the governor of Kebbi State, praised the Department of Security Services for identifying those who it says are plotting to install an interim government. This after the group called on the security organization to arrest those behind the alleged scheme. For the latest development, I reach Ibrahim Momo. He is a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Whereas those who lost out in the last general elections in Nigeria are kind of agitating or encouraging the institution of something like an interim government, such that the duly elected, the president-elect should not be, Bola Ahmed Tinubu should not be sworn in. But for me, I think, as an analyst, I think that there are further ramifications on it, because it is not, the elections are held, we're not just about the presidency. The call for an international government, even though it is aimed at preventing the president-elect Bola Ahmed Tinubu from being sworn into office, it has far-reaching ramifications, because it will grind to a halt the wheels of government across the executive and legislative arms of government, both at its national and subnational levels.
For those who purportedly lost the election and are calling for, did they call for an interim government publicly?
Well, in a manner of speaking, the opposition elements have not, across the two major losing parties, the People Democratic Party, the PDP, and the Labour Party, they have not particularly mentioned the word interim national government, but they have very much made statements purportedly suggesting it. For example, the main opposition party's candidate, Atiku Abubakar, the PDP's candidate, Atiku Abubakar, who came second in the poll, in reaction to the DSS statement, that it can't be, you cannot stop people for protesting a flawed process, whilst the vice presidential candidate, so Peter Obi of the Labour Party, has said that they won the election. The candidate of the APC, the party that won the election, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, he actually said that he doesn't consider him president-elect. So these are statements that are not actually talking about international government per se, but suggestive of the fact that he shouldn't be sworn in as president.
But Ibrahim, for the ordinary Nigerian who say that many more people, maybe two times more people, voted for the opposition than the president-elect, which they said could possibly weaken his administration, do you see this happening?
That is one way to look at it. Because every one of them, every candidate was there to get votes. But what the candidate of the APC is arguing is that he got the majority of votes cast in his favor. That's how it began. Not the fact that more people voted against him, at least for other 17 candidates, than the one that voted for him. So that's how they are playing. So it's neither here nor there. The argument that because people are saying that when you have a challenge with the election outcome, the ideal thing, the proper thing to do is to approach the courts. In first instance, the tribunal, the presidential election tribunal, which is what those parties have done. The PDP has filed a preliminary case with the presidential tribunal, election tribunal, and then the Labour Party too has done since. So people are saying that is a due process, that is a proper thing to do rather than, this other agitation for international government.
The DSS statement said that they are aware of, they have identified some individuals who are agitating or calling for this interim government. The question a lot of people are also asking is, if people are suggesting that it is treasonous to call for an interim government, those people who are calling for it might have broken the law and should have been arrested as part of their investigation. What's your take, or how are people reacting to this?
Yeah, that's the point that some analysts have made, that the global best practice is that if you have people undermining the electoral process or calling for constitutional means of stopping the enthronement of the duly elected president, what they are saying is that what the DSS ought to do, rather than putting out public statements, you should go after those individuals and get them arrested. But the main opposition parties are saying that this is an attempt to, arrest opposition elements. And so the DSS is in a bind.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. He spoke with me from Abuja. Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA. Vice President Kamala Harris landed in Zambia Friday, the final stop on a week-long tour of the continent. While there, she discussed debt restructuring with that nation's president and announced a range of private sector commitments worth more than $7 billion aimed at supporting climate resilience, adaptation, and mitigation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
For Vice President Kamala Harris, this stop is a special one. She visited the Southern African nation as a young girl when her grandfather was stationed here. A homecoming is how Zambia's president described Friday's visit by Harris as he led her through the lush grounds of the presidential palace, where zebras, giraffes, and peacocks roamed. Harris, too, basked in nostalgia as she made an unannounced stop at a property in central Lusaka, now occupied by a modern, nondescript office compound, where records show her grandfather once lived. But this two-day stop, tail end of her Africa tour, also involved a difficult subject. The landlocked but copper-rich nation was the first African nation to default on its sovereign debt when the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020. On Friday, President Hakainde Hichilema appealed to Harris for U.S. help in restructuring the debt, which is nearing $15 billion.
What is keeping us down for now, Vice President, is the debt overhang. We carry a debt burden that really is making it difficult for us to continue with our restructuring process of the economy. And it's actually beginning to negate on the gains we've already made, such as in the foreign exchange market. And the earlier we resolve this matter, the better. And we ask for your support, as always, and the support of others to deal with that. And we know when we unlock the debt, more investments will come. We know that when more investments come, we'll create jobs for our young people.
Harris announced a range of private and public sector commitments covering anti-corruption efforts, economic and democratic reforms, agriculture, and more. And she supported his call for restructuring the debt, most of which is owed to Chinese lenders.
We will continue to advocate for a speedy finalization of Zambia's debt treatment and the restructuring. And we have talked extensively about that. Our administration believes the international community needs to help countries such as Zambia regain their footing. So I will reiterate a call that we have made now many times for all bilateral official creditors to provide a meaningful debt reduction for Zambia.
Her swing through Zambia also includes a trip to a farm outside Lusaka and a meeting with entrepreneurs. Throughout this week-long trip that took her across the continent, Harris has reflected publicly on the historic ties between Africa and the U.S. She spoke of the evils of slavery and the importance of teaching accurate history, even when it is painful, after she toured the slave dungeons in Ghana's infamous Cape Coast Castle. But Zambia was personal. She spoke of the impact of her grandfather, who advised the first president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda.
I think as an extension of the work that he did here as an advisor to President Kaunda, it was really, he cared deeply about freedom and independence. And I was the eldest grandchild, and so I got the benefit and the blessing of a lot of time with him as a young child, where he would really talk about that.
She returns home to Washington Sunday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Lusaka.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris ends a week-long Africa trip in Zambia. Key on her agenda was a scheduled meeting with President Hakainde Hichilema to discuss multilateral agreement as well as deepening ties between Washington and Lusaka. It was the second time Harris greets Hichilema following their meeting at the U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit held last year in Washington, D.C. The trip comes as Zambia appears to be receiving a lot of attention from the U.S., including a recent visit by U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. For more about the U.S. Vice President visit and the relationship between the two countries, I raised Zambian Foreign Minister Stanley Kakubu via Microsoft Teams. Here is the concluding part of this conversation.
Zambia seemed to be having a lot of attention from Washington. What will Zambia do with all these attentions that you're getting?
Our strategy is to take advantage of the goodwill that's out there. It shows that our hard work is paying off. This government is going in the right direction. I'm happy, again, you've mentioned the issue of the U.S.-Africa summit. At that summit, if you recall, the U.S. government made a pronouncement of the $15 billion investment in Africa, and we want a slice of that cake. And we were encouraged when Secretary Yellen came into Zambia, and we enhanced those discussions. And then for the discussions that we had with Secretary Yellen to be followed by enhanced discussions with the U.S. Vice President, it means that we are getting closer to establishing a proper framework, a proper strategy of how we can get some of that money sitting here in Lusaka in terms of investments. And already we are getting a good vibe, a good indication from the U.S. private sector that they want to have a footprint in our economy. And that can only be positive. And we want to enhance that partnership.
Well, Zambia recently was scheduled to host the Democracy Summit from the 29th to the 30th. Now, how would this help in entrenching democracy in Zambia and the full embrace of the tenets of democracy? Because the U.S. government, the Biden administration, invited over 120 global leaders to participate in this summit.
First of all, democracy in our country is entrenched already. It's really in the fabric of the Zambian society. We've had seven presidents. The current president is the seventh president. And from the time that we got independent, we've had four political parties, different political parties, not just having an election and the same party takes over, but four different political parties. It shows you that Zambia's democratic credentials are solid. And of course, not perfect. We must continue to perfect that. An opportunity for us to host the Democratic Summit, SD4, is important for us. I mean, it gives us an opportunity to showcase our democratic credentials. It also gives us an opportunity to tell the Zambian story on democracy, because we are trying to encourage our region, Africa, and the rest of the world to go the democratic route. We also want to show the dividends of democracy to the world. And then also, because we are hosting the summit, because of our shared values with countries such as the U.S. and all the other countries that are participating, because we truly, truly believe in the rule of law. We truly believe in the rights of our people. We truly believe in the democracy that encourages elections so that leaders are picked by the people. The people have a say in the democratic dispensation, and Zambia, I think, is well-placed to have a say also to co-host a summit of this magnitude. It's basically on shared values, and this is one of the values that we share with the US and also with the other countries that are participating.
Before we go, Mr. Foreign Minister, you were recently here. You held meetings in Washington with other top officials of the government. Where do you want to see the relationship between Washington and Lusaka as a foreign minister?
Well, the thrust of Zambia's foreign policy is really economic diplomacy. We want to go beyond the handshakes and the smiles and everything that go with it. We want solid business relationships because we want to secure the future of our young people in this country, and we want to do actual, tangible and traceable transactions between the US, between Lusaka and Washington. We want the business, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, in other words. We want to take advantage. We want to leverage on other countries' technology. And I think US is one such as an example. And we are focused on other countries as well. Ours is to ensure that peace prevails, democracy prevails. And in a peaceful environment, it's almost limitless what a country can achieve. We can pursue anything. And we are thinking that our improved relations with the US, with the US people, with the US government, gives us a fantastic platform to tap into that market, to tap into that technology, to tap into that business environment. And we want to bring most of that business back home in order for us to grow our economy, to give jobs to our people. And I think that's the direction Zambia is looking to go.
Stanley Kakubo is the Zambian foreign minister. He spoke with me via Microsoft Teams from the capital, Lusaka. Malawi's government has told refugees and asylum seekers to relocate to the country's lone refugee camp by April 15 or face forced eviction from their homes. The Ministry of Homeland Security said in a statement Thursday, the new deadline follows the expiry of the February 1 deadline the government set last year for about 8,000 refugees who settled outside the Dzaleka refugee camp. For the UAE, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
Ian Zikari Ngoma is the Minister of Homeland Security in Malawi. He says in a statement that the move is in line with Malawi's encampment policy, which prohibits refugees from staying outside a refugee camp. Ngoma says the Dzaleka camp in central Malawi has facilities that meet international standards for all refugees and asylum seekers, including primary and secondary schools, a health center, and a public market. Rafael Ndabaga, a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, disputes that. Ndabaga lived outside the Dzaleka camp before returning ahead of a February 1 deadline the government made last year.
The advantage of living in the city, you have many opportunities than the camp. In the city, if you're a business person, you can open a shop and you are able to make a living because you can get some income. You can prosper because rather than the camp, which has only refugees.
Ndabaga says that in the city, his three children were able to go to better schools than those in and around the refugee camp. Ken Emmanuel Rukajo is Associate External Relations and Reporting Officer for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, in Malawi. He told VOA Friday that the refugee agency would make an official comment on the new deadline later. However, the UNHCR had previously expressed concerns when the Malawi government issued the first relocation order in August of last year. It said in a statement that the relocation would result in extreme pressure on the camp's already inadequate health services, water, shelter, and sanitation. But the Malawi government says in its new order that the refugees were already given ample time to make necessary arrangements for the relocation. It warns that those resisting the new deadline will be forcefully evicted from their homes. Business operators in Malawi have long threatened to forcibly evict refugees from market areas, saying they are bringing unnecessary competition in terms of prices of goods. Tennyson Mulimbula is the general secretary for the Small Scale Business Operators Association in Malawi.
If you go to their shops, you find that they stock farm produce items like beans, rice, peas, which they receive at the refugee camp. They go there, they take them and put them into the shops, and just because they receive them freely, then they start selling them at a lower price.
But some refugee traders who asked not to be named for fear of reprisals deny selling items from the refugee camp. The government says state agencies such as the Malawi Police Service and the Department of Immigration and Citizenship Services will be involved in the relocation exercise. It added that any person or group of persons found harassing the refugees and asylum seekers in any way will be arrested. Zaleka is home to refugees and asylum seekers from Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Somalia. The camp was originally meant to accommodate about 10,000 refugees, but now it is a home to more than 50,000. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
As Ethiopia's civil war comes to an end, along with a communications blackout in the Tigray region, the Red Cross is helping refugee families who fled to Sudan find relatives who were unable to escape the conflict. For viewing, Henry Wilkins met with one in Khartoum who is desperately looking for his lost relative.
In Khartoum, a long-established community of expatriates from Ethiopia's Tigray region is seeing new arrivals, refugees who fled the two-year-long war in Tigray. Even though it ended with a peace agreement in November, some still trickle in from the refugee camps close to Ethiopia's border. Getachew is one of them. VOA is not using his real name to protect him and his family. Now that phone and internet service has been restored in Tigray, many, like Getachew, are searching for missing relatives they were separated from in the war. Getachew has not seen his father, a soldier in the Tigrayan army, since the war began. He says his father was in the military, he was a soldier, but there's no information on whether he is alive or dead. Even my family can't find my father, he says. I don't have anyone to ask. Specialists from the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, are helping people like Getachew find their families. Andreas Nazis Shadin is an ICRC protection officer.
As if they lost contact with their loved ones, then we provide them tracing service, both receiving from abroad and sending from here.
ICRC is one of the humanitarian organizations which is allowed to operate in Tigray. Both sides in Ethiopia's conflict have been accused of crimes against humanity, but the extent of the ethnic cleansing which is alleged to have taken place in Tigray is not yet known. Journalists and human rights investigators have not been given access to the region by Ethiopian authorities. VOA asked if the ICRC's tracing service can provide any insights into the scale of the atrocities in Tigray. Pascal Katat is the ICRC head of delegation in Sudan.
Now, I don't have specific statistics with regard to this context here, but we have thousands of people who are looked for by a family member. And we have dozens of resolved cases. Of course, the cases resolved will increase.
Katad says most cases take a long time to solve, if they're solved at all. But Getachew continues his search with the help of Shardin. He says he called his grandparents to ask where his father is, but they don't know anything. Because of the war, I can't find my family, and I can't live without them, he added. His search is unlikely to bear fruit, but he is not giving up. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Nigeria's former prime minister has applauded the U.S. Agency for International Development for its support in fighting AIDS, saying the country cannot afford to treat patients on its own. USAID has called on the Ugandan government to put the needs of such patients at the forefront in light of the recently passed anti-homosexuality bill. For VOA, Halima Atumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
An estimated 1.2 million Ugandans aged 15 to 64 are living with HIV/AIDS and surviving on antiretroviral drugs. Almost all HIV/AIDS patients receive the drugs through financial support from the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Uganda's former Prime Minister, Ruhakana Rugunda, speaking as chief guest at celebrations to mark the 60th anniversary of the USAID partnership with Uganda, painted a picture of what HIV/AIDS was before U.S. support. Rugunda recalled that as the AIDS pandemic ravaged the country in the 1990s and early 2000s, the government had no means to afford treatment for patients.
We knew that AIDS drugs had been developed and they could control AIDS in many ways. The problem we had in Uganda was the drug is there, the people are here needing the drugs, but there is a gap. How does Uganda fill the gap? The taxpayer in Uganda, even if he or she was squeezed so hard, could not fill the gap.
In more recent years, Uganda has registered significant success in the fight against HIV, as seen in reduced HIV prevalence and a decline in new infections. USAID Uganda Mission Director Richard Nelson says his agency and its partners have prioritized HIV/AIDS for the last 20 years and are getting close to control of the epidemic, but some obstacles remain. Uganda's parliament this month passed the anti-homosexuality bill that criminalizes identifying as LGBT, mandates life in prison for gay sex, and imposes a possible death sentence for certain homosexual acts. Nelson says they are watching the bill's progress carefully because it could scare away people from seeking treatment for HIV or AIDS.
The last remaining work that needs to be done to reach epidemic control involves some of these key populations. And so if those key populations are unable to access services, if it's difficult for us to provide those services, it will really jeopardize our ability to reach our goals of eliminating HIV/AIDS by 2030.
Even before the bill was passed by Parliament, organizations providing HIV/AIDS care services were seeing people shy away from getting antiretroviral drugs. Henry Muchibi is the founder of one such group, Children of the Sun, and he spoke with VOA.
I've seen the number of people who are HIV positive. The number of people who are suppressing now is going down because now people are in fear of getting health services in public facilities.
According to the Uganda AIDS Commission, stigma, denial, discrimination, inaction, and violations of human rights continue to be major barriers to effective national responses to HIV. The anti-homosexuality bill, described by activists as deeply devastating and discriminatory, now awaits President Yoweri Museveni's veto or signature. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, has historically relied on Russia and Ukraine for a sizable proportion of fertilizer and grain needs. But the war in Ukraine has forced Kenya to take steps to become more self-sufficient. From VOA, Victoria Amunga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The disruption of Ukrainian agriculture caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine is creating a shortage of commodities in African countries like Kenya that heavily rely on imported grain and products like fertilizer and irrigation equipment. To help meet the challenge, the U.S. government is working with Kenyan agricultural sector companies to strengthen the industry. Development agency USAID says it's critically important to invest in agriculture to reduce shocks that arise from external events. David Gosney is the agency's mission director in Kenya.
There will be more work that will be able to capitalize on new technologies in terms of seeds and other productivity means. And we already talked about things like solar irrigation and others, which basically get at the critical factor which you're highlighting here.
Kenyan fertilizer producers like David Abak told VOA that his farm, Synergy, will double organic fertilizer production. He was awarded $1.2 million to produce fertilizer for Kenya and farmers this year.
Being able to produce locally is really valuable. And our organic fertilizer, it's increasing farmer crop yields by 30%. We're working with about 10,000 farmers across 1,000 agrivets in just about every county in Kenya. And this support from USAID helps us accelerate our production so we can reach all these farmers even faster.
The United States announced grants worth $5.1 million to agricultural sector companies Monday at an American Chamber of Commerce summit in Nairobi. Moses Kuria, Kenya's Minister of Trade and Investment, told the forum that the two nations' principles have been key to such collaborations.
It is a joint initiative because we are negotiating on the basis of shared values. The values we share on diversity, the values we share on climate change and sustainability, the values we share on digital trade.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has been on a week-long visit to Africa. She has said America will increase investment in Africa and help spur economic growth in the region. Harris is the fifth top U.S. official to visit the continent this year. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 then 202-258-3076.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. British-born former heavyweight champion of Nigerian descent, Anthony Joshua, returned to winning ways with a unanimous points decision victory over Jermaine Franklin in their heavyweight boxing bout at London's O2 Arena on Saturday. After 12 rounds, Joshua was given the win by 118-111, 117-111, 117-111 on the scorecards of the three judges. This was the 33-year-old former world heavyweight champion Joshua's first victory since 2020 after successive defeats by Oleksandr Usyk saw the former Olympic champion lose and then fail to regain his global titles.
It's good to be back in the ring after 8 to 9 months out of the ring. It's not good to take that much time out of the ring. You know, if you want to be good at something, you've got to do it consistently. Coach got me in the right position to compete for 12 rounds against someone that wasn't ready to go. Maybe I could have let my hands go a bit more.
In athletics, Kenya's Irene Jepchumba Kimais and Ronsa Kipkori Kunga were comfortable winners at the Prague Half Marathon on Saturday. In the female category, Jepchumba Kimais won the World Athletics Elite Label Road Race in 1 hour 6 seconds, the second fastest time of her career after the 1 hour 4 minutes 37 seconds personal best she set in Barcelona earlier this year. Fellow Kenyan Janet Chipchenajich finished second in 1 hour 6 minutes 42 seconds, while Ethiopian Ray Bezabe completed the podium in 1 hour 7 minutes 15 seconds. In the men's race, Ronsa Kipkori Kunga won in 59 minutes 43 seconds. Ugandan's Maxwell Rotich was second in 1 hour 6 seconds, which was 5 seconds ahead of Kenya's Geoffrey Kuich, who came in third.
In cricket news, Rwanda is among three countries that will be participating for the first time at the Victoria Challenge Cricket Championship in Kampala, Uganda from April 16th to the 23rd. The regional women cricket competition, which will be played at the Lugogo Cricket Oval, will see Rwanda, Tanzania and the United Arab Emirates as the new participating teams joining Kenya and host nation Uganda. The Rwanda female team is among the top cricket nations in Africa as they reach the Super Six of the Under-19 Women's World Cup in South Africa in January 2023. And now to rugby, where Kenya Sevens rugby team Shujaa suffered their third consecutive defeat in Hong Kong after losing 26-17 to African rivals South Africa in the Pool D match on April 1st. Shujaa began their campaign with a 29-5 loss to New Zealand before also firing blanks against Ireland after going down 26-14 in the eighth round of the 2022-2023 World Rugby Sevens Series. For the eighth consecutive tournament, Kenya has failed to make it to the main cup quarters. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Direct from Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The official visit of the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, have been widely and extensively covered by the local and international press. This visit is symbolic in many ways. The people of the countries she visited have warmly welcomed a measured tone and message. This is also symbolic on the selection of the states she visited. The first was Ghana. Ghana has symbolized Africa's struggle for national independence. Ghana has also become the home, symbolically, of many Pan-Africanists from many parts of the Caribbean. The Vice President also visited Tanzania, where also currently you have the first president of that country. Although previously the African continent had seen Madam Presidents from Liberia and Malawi. The visit of the Vice President was a continuation of what was discussed and agreed in December summit meeting between President Biden and African heads of state and government. It was the furtherance of the commitment and program that we discussed at that summit. Vice President Harris, a very articulate legal mind, spoke in measured ways and tried to convince the people of Africa, particularly women and youth, that America has turned a new page in its dealings with Africa. And when she went to Zambia, where her grandfather was once a diplomat, she renewed her acquaintances. And Zambia represents a country that is now trying to strengthen the foundation of democracy. Africa has ups and down relationship with the United States. In some situation, the media try to suggest that this visit and those that preceded it, for example, by the First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, the Secretary of State, Blinken, and the Treasury Secretary, Yellen, were all to counter China and Russia influence in Africa. But the government itself and other spokespersons for the government have denied that this was their intention. It was indeed a new chapter, but one to convince Africans that the government of the United States was caring for them. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Would you like to be famous? Calling us on WhatsApp may gain you fame if we play your message on the radio. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. Here's that number again. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
If you're in or not, oh no, oh no, oh no. Got to the chase, mamacita. Come have a taste, senorita. The cage I ride with you on me and smoke up till the morning. There she goes, make me lose control. She run wild, shokori, shoko. Close my game, call up, be coco. Nobody knows. Let's keep it on low. No mind them, shokori, shoko. If you need me, call on me, coco.
Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English Service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how you fix a chimpanzee's nose, it will still remain ugly. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.